This particular article is headlined, and by the way, this article is authored by Rick Eyerdam, E-Y-E-R-D-A-M. It's headlined, Arrow Air Delivered Arms for Contras. It's subheaded, Company Received Work Through Southern Air, and it's datelined Miami. This particular story reads as follows. Arrow Air served as a secret transatlantic airline carrying weapons and military supplies from the Middle East and Europe to arm the Nicaraguan Contras, the South Florida Business Journal has learned. The opening paragraph again, because that basically is the sort of thesis statement of the whole article and central to the understanding of tonight's broadcast. Arrow Air served as a secret transatlantic airline carrying weapons and military supplies from the Middle East and Europe to arm the Nicaraguan Contras, the South Florida Business Journal has learned. The evidence comes from several different sources. Secret testimony by an official of Southern Air Transport, which hired Miami-based Arrow Air to ship the arms. Testimony by an operative of Oliver North and the National Security Council. A source who witnessed some of the shipments. A little-known deposition by arms dealer Albert Hakim for the Congressional Iran-Contra Committee, and an investigation conducted by a member of the Canadian Aviation Safety Board. Arif Durrani, D-U-R-R-A-N-I, an American citizen of Pakistani birth who was arrested for supplying Hawk missile parts to Iran and who claims his company was used by the CIA to ship small arms to the Contras, says Arrow Air frequently was the airline used to ship arms to the Contras and to Iran. In February of 1987, before the Iran-Contra connection was revealed, Durrani filed documents in federal court in Connecticut identifying Arrow Air as a carrier of illegal arms to Iran. Durrani provided the sworn statement as part of his defense against felony charges that he had illegally sold Hawk missile parts to Iran. He claimed he was a CIA insider and that his clandestine efforts were part of the CIA National Security Council effort to trade the missile parts for hostages held in Lebanon. U.S. Customs official did not investigate the claims. The government denied that Durrani was part of its arms for hostage efforts. At Durrani's trial, witnesses representing Customs and the CIA denied that Arrow Air had ever shipped arms either to Iran or to the Contras. However, since Durrani's conviction, evidence has emerged that contradicts that testimony. Transcripts of FBI interrogations of individuals involved in the Iran-Contra scandal reveal that Arrow Air received a subcontract from Southern Air to handle top-secret flights to Iran and to supply the Contras. Interrupting briefly, of course, it was Southern Air Transport that Eugene Hassenfuss was flying for when he was shot down on a Contra supply mission over Nicaragua that precipitated the Iran-Contra scandal. Continuing with the article here from the South Florida Business Journal, the transcripts cover interviews with David Mulligan, an official with Miami-based Southern Air Transport, and Richard Gadd, G-A-D-D, a retired U.S. Air Force lieutenant colonel who owns several front companies used by North, Hakim, and Richard Secord. Quote, "We did not operate 707 aircraft, and it had to be done with a jet airplane because of the payload," unquote, Mulligan told investigators. Quote, "I became the point of contact with Dick Gadd on these trips," he said later in his interrogation. "I contracted with Arrow Air to do two trips," unquote. Mulligan confirmed the substance of the transcripts but could not remember the exact dates. "Southern Air Transport is not a CIA airline, and it has done nothing illegal," he said. Through his secretary, Arrow Air owner George Batchelor declined to comment on the matter. His secretary referred questions about arms shipments to Harry Weisberg, Batchelor's attorney and a vice president at International Air Leasing, another Batchelor enterprise. By press time, Weisberg had not been reached for comment. Gadd's top-secret testimony showed that after he retired from the Air Force, he, quote, "assisted the U.S. government in those types of operations not necessarily covert," unquote. "Classified operations?" the investigator asked. "Classified operations," Gadd responded. The retired officer testified that two weapons shipments he handled were subcontracted by Southern Air to Arrow Air, paid for by Secord, and handled by a Canadian company, quote, "something to the effect of Transamerica Arms," unquote. In his February 4, 1987 statement, Durrani said that on one occasion he and George Hassan, H-A-S-S-A-N, an Iranian CIA agent, examined a plane load of Sidewinder missiles that were taken out of NATO and Portuguese military stocks for shipment to Iran. Hassan showed me an airplane belonging to Arrow Air, an American company at the Air Force Base in Lisbon. The plane was a Boeing 707, the Durrani affidavit said. At the time, Durrani said, he was a consultant to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's procurement office in London. As part of an interview from his Oregon prison block, Durrani described how he ended up caught between the CIA and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. Because I am a Muslim and an arms expert, and because the Revolutionary Guard did not have the expertise on these matters, they trusted me to know everything about their dealings with the Americans and the Israelis so that they would not get cheated any longer by the North and the Israelis, he said. Durrani's claims about close contact with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard were confirmed by U.S. Customs and other federal agents at his trial. Durrani said that it was common knowledge in the arms community that Arrow Air was an American proprietary airline, and that its planes sometimes were painted in other colors or painted to obscure their American registration numbers. The DC-8 that was used to carry the first shipment of Hawks was a charter from Arrow, Durrani said. Everybody makes the same mistake, he added. They all think that the arms were carried by Southern Air Transport. But Southern Air took all the Arrow Air aircraft and used them. Southern Air only had C-130s, which was fine to fly from North America to Central America, but not to cross the ocean. The arms for the Contras were often transported on Arrow Air 707s and DC-8s from Portugal to Canada, Durrani said. The company involved in Canada was Trans World Arms, a company set up by the CIA that Secord was involved in, unquote. Durrani said that in addition to seeing the Arrow Air jets loading on the ground in Portugal, he also saw shipping documents in the possession of his Iranian and CIA friends. Quote, I physically saw the documents, and the CIA people in Portugal told me about the Arrow Air flights and the Canadian company, he said. Durrani declined to identify the CIA agent by name, but he identified the CIA station in Portugal where he saw the records and where they can be found, a penthouse at 33 Avenue do Brasil in Lisbon. Quote, I had dinner there with a CIA guy and his Austrian girl, Durrani said. They showed me the files, unquote. Lester Salotis, here it's spelled with an S in the L.A. Times article from 12-12-89, it was spelled with an F. Lester Salotis, the former Canadian Aviation Safety Board member, claims he was fired because of his inquiries into Arrow Air's clandestine operations and because of his efforts to reopen the investigation into the crash of an Arrow Air charter at Gander, Newfoundland in December of 1985. Salotis said his research confirms Durrani's story. Much of his information comes from a little-known appendix to the Iran-Contra hearings that contains a set of communications between arms dealer Hakim and Trans World Arms. Quote, there is an agreement of aircraft, there is an agreement of aircraft charter from Southern Air subcontracted to Arrow Air, he said, and the consignee to Trans World Arms and the charter is Trans World Arms, and the aircraft is a DC-863 with a payload of 95,000 pounds of Class E explosives. Quote, it departs Lisbon, Portugal on January 22, 1985, with a load of 95,000 pounds of Class E explosives provided by DEFEX, D-E-F-E-X, of Portugal, he continued. It stops at the Azores, then it is supposed to fly on to Guatemala City, unquote. But Salotis said he checked with the Federal Aviation Administration and found that the flight plan was changed en route. The new destination was El Salvador. Records of the Iran-Contra hearings show dozens of flights by Caribou aircraft and other planes that are capable of carrying arms from North America to Central America. The Iran-Contra hearings also revealed that most of the arms purchased by North, Secord, and Hakim were secured either in Portugal, Israel, or Egypt, most through DEFEX. But there is no record, other than one shipload of arms from Israel, of how the tons of munitions were transported across the ocean. So reviewing here the basic points of this article, it is apparent from a number of different sources, and they are listed in that article, and that, by the way, is the entire article, it is apparent that Arrow Air was one of the many CIA or one of the American Air proprietaries that was involved in one facet or another of the Iran-Contra scandal and the attendant arms transactions. It is also apparent that Arif Durrani was one of the individuals whose information concerning the Arrow Air CIA Iran-Contra scandal connection was accurate. And it should be noted that Arif Durrani himself, convicted of selling missile parts to Iran, apparently was doing so, as we shall see, in an official capacity, despite the fact that his conviction stands and despite the fact that his many, many disclosures concerning his Iran-Contra-related activities have been actively suppressed by the authorities. It should be noted here again that Arrow Air, quite obviously working on behalf of elements of CIA, Arrow Air, quite obviously being used by the so-called secret team, as the Christic Institute has dubbed many of the key players in the Iran-Contra scandal, Arrow Air obviously was being used for some of the arms scams involved in that massive, massive scandal. And it is apparent that there are also key discrepancies in the official version of the crash of the Arrow Air plane in Gander, Newfoundland. We will take a look at, we've already looked at the fact that eyewitnesses said the plane was on fire. We've taken a look at the fact that people who were servicing the plane testified there was no ice on the wings when they serviced it on the ground. We've taken a look at the fact that apparently, at least according to verified reports, the Egyptian guard assigned to guard the plane on the ground in Egypt left his post several times. Perhaps there were explosives or something was put on the plane at that time. We will also, in an article which we will be coming back to after a musical break, be taking a look at information concerning the forensic pathological report on some of the victims of the Arrow Air crash, which would seem to indicate that there was an explosion or fire on board before the plane crashed, and that indeed the eyewitness accounts which stated that there was a fire just before the plane hit the ground. The official version says the plane began burning on the ground as a result of the crash. There we will begin taking a look at information that would contradict the official version, and which not only indicates that there was a fire on board the plane, but we will look at forensic evidence that perhaps there was an explosion on board the plane, and indications that in fact something appears to have blown up on that particular Arrow Air flight that went down in Gander in December of 1985. In the upcoming article, and again, this article comes from Details magazine that we will be going into after a break, we will also take a look at the investigations done by Gene Wheaton, a former Army Criminal Investigative Division operative who has been looking into many of the Iran-Contra-related activities and who has become a mainstay of information for, among others, the Christic Institute. We'll take a look at Gene Wheaton's investigations into the Arrow Air crash and indications that perhaps the apparent terrorist bombing of the Arrow airplane, which went down in Gander, Newfoundland, may very well have been directly connected to Arrow Air's activities in the Iran-Contra scandal. We're going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back with more information about the Gander crash in December of 85. Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. This evening we're taking a look at the crash of a Gander, among other things I should say, the crash of an Arrow airplane in Gander, Newfoundland in December of 1985, which killed some 250 or so American soldiers. There are, to say the least, enormous discrepancies between information which has been reliably developed by investigators and the official version of the crash. The official version of the crash is that it was just an accident and probably due to icing on the wings. Eyewitnesses have testified in contradiction to the official version that in fact the plane appeared to have been on fire before it crashed. The official version says the fire stemmed from the crash itself once it hit the ground. Also, people who serviced the plane on the ground testified that in fact there was no ice on the wings, icing on the wings having been listed as the probable source of the crash. Beyond that, there is the curious behavior of the Egyptian guard assigned to guard the plane. He apparently left his post several times for unexplained reasons. And it is also apparent that Arrow Air was involved with the Iran-Contra scandal, and that specifically some of the arms shipments that were involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, the Iranian arms transfers and the Contra support arms traffic, that Arrow Air was involved in that traffic and that some of their flights were carrying weapons. We are now going to take a look at information which further highlights the contradictions between verifiable physical reality vis-a-vis the Gander crash and the official version. We're going to take a look at forensic evidence, forensic pathological evidence that indicates that in fact there was a fire on board the plane before it crashed. We're going to take a look at Gene Wheaton's investigations into the Gander crash. We're going to take a look at the connections. We're going to review some of Arif Durrani, the Pakistani-born arms trafficker and apparent player in the Iran-Contra scandal. We're going to take a, we're going to review his connections to ArrowAir, his observations concerning ArrowAir, and we're going to take a look at indications of an ongoing cover-up of the true facts concerning this particular crash. There are disturbing indications that the crash of ArrowAir was not only due to a terrorist bomb, and it should be noted that Islamic Jihad, an Iranian-backed Lebanese-based terrorist group, took credit for the crash hours after the plane went down. But there are disturbing indications that the crash may specifically, this terrorist, apparent terrorist incident, may very well have been connected directly to the Iran-Contra scandal itself. The next piece of information that we're going to enter into the archives is a very important, very excellent article that appeared in, of all things, Details Magazine, not normally a publication which carries a lot of political information. This specifically comes from Details Magazine's issue of December of 1990. This is an article by Joe Connison, C-O-N-A-S-O-N. He is editor-at-large of Details Magazine, or so described here. He also writes for The Village Voice. And this particular article by Joe Connison is headlined, Crash, Burn, and Cover-Up. Subhead, Detective Gene Wheaton probes an unsolved murder. There were 256 victims. And I'm going to read a long section of this particular article into the archives. It should be noted again that Gene Wheaton is a former investigator for the Army's Criminal Investigative Division, an individual who has done a lot of research into various aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, an individual who also has provided a lot of information, as I mentioned earlier, to the Christic Institute in their ongoing suit against many of the key players in that scandal. That, in a nutshell, is Gene Wheaton's background, and we're now going to take a look at some of the forensic pathological evidence concerning the autopsy information developed on some of the victims of the Gander crash, and as related here to us by Joe Connison through the aforementioned Gene Wheaton, it is apparent that there was, or certainly there are very severe indications from the pathological evidence, aside from the eyewitness accounts, that in fact the Arrow airplane which crashed in Gander was on fire before it hit the ground. And as we begin on page 28 here, and we move about halfway into Joe Connison's article, Crash, Burn, Cover-Up. The Wheaton here, of course, is Gene Wheaton. We begin. As Wheaton pored over the forensic evidence, he became increasingly convinced that a pre-crash explosion or fire probably destroyed the plane. There were the five eyewitnesses, all of whom testified that the aircraft appeared to be spewing flames before it went down. These accounts were backed by Irving Pinkel, P-I-N-K-E-L, an internationally recognized consulting engineer who ran NASA's probe of the Apollo 1 fire that killed three astronauts. In May of 1986, he visited Gander and went over what was left of the company's DC-8 piece by piece. Pinkel discovered a fuselage panel from the airplane's right side bearing an elliptical hole about a foot long. This hole had a pronounced outward pucker, unquote, which Pinkel considered, quote, strong evidence of explosion damage, unquote. That last sentence again, or last two sentences. Pinkel discovered a fuselage panel from the plane's right side bearing an elliptical hole about a foot long. This hole had a pronounced outward pucker, unquote, which Pinkel considered, quote, strong evidence of explosion damage, unquote. He found a second, similarly damaged section of the plane's skin and turned both pieces over to authorities. The CASB said the holes were caused either by fire or by, quote, an object being forced through, unquote, after the crash. There was also the gruesome tale uncovered by the 254 full autopsies. The antiseptic language of the morgue didn't reckon, of course, with the intense suffering of those who were alive, just barely, in the wreckage during the moments after the plane struck Earth. But it did reveal elevated levels of carbon monoxide, a gas produced when the craft's interior caught fire, in the tissues of dozens of bodies. This seemed to indicate a pre-impact explosion and fire because some soldiers who had died instantly, heads severed or chests crushed, were found to have high levels of carbon monoxide in their tissues. Pathologists disagree about the meaning of this evidence, but the famous coroner Dr. Cyril Wecht, W-E-C-H-T, has pointed out that a headless soldier with his torso split open cannot inhale carbon monoxide gas. These last couple of sentences, again, or the last several sentences, and concerning the autopsies, it did reveal elevated levels of carbon monoxide, a gas produced when the craft's interior caught fire in the tissues of dozens of bodies. This seemed to indicate a pre-impact explosion and fire because some soldiers who had died instantly, heads severed or chests crushed, were found to have high levels of carbon monoxide in their tissues. Pathologists disagree about the meaning of this evidence, but the famous coroner Dr. Cyril Wecht has pointed out that a headless soldier with his torso split open cannot inhale carbon monoxide gas. No, indeed, he cannot. It's also interesting that Dr. Cyril Wecht has provided testimony, hard testimony, concerning the impossibility of the single bullet theory in the assassination of John F. Kennedy, a name who we have examined, or an individual we have looked at before. So in addition to the curiously shaped or curiously deformed fuselage panel from the plane, there is autopsy evidence, namely the high levels of carbon monoxide in the tissues of many of those who died in the crash, indicating that they had breathed that carbon monoxide before they suffered the gross trauma, which killed them apparently almost instantly when they died. As we continue here with Gene Wheaton's observations concerning the meaning of this evidence, as Gene Wheaton read this abstruse material, what struck him was the lack of context. Why, in dismissing the possibility of a terrorist bombing, had the Canadians ignored the events surrounding the accident at the end of 1985? It had been a bloody year of terror, including a CIA-sponsored car bombing in Beirut, the Achille Lauro hijacking in October, several attacks on American bases in Germany, and the Rome and Vienna airport massacres that took place just after the Gander crash. And I would interrupt that it was in calendar years 85 and 86 that to Oliver North and Amiram Nir-Nisker, the late unfortunate Amiram Nir-Nisker, were collaborating in coordinating U.S. and Israeli counter-terror policy. Note also that Manzer El-Kassar, associate of Oliver North and other elements of U.S. intelligence and a key player certainly in the Iran-Contra scandal and apparently in the Pan Am 103 bombing, he was very close to, among others, the Abu Abbas group, which was involved in the Achille Lauro hijacking. We also looked at, in Radio Free America 32M, the aforementioned two-part miscellaneous archive series about the fascist third position, that a German neo-Nazi named Otfried Hepp was affiliated with Abu Abbas's group, and that Hepp and some of his neo-Nazi associates in Germany and Europe associated with the fascist third position were behind many of the attacks on American installations in Europe, which were initially attributed to leftist or Middle Eastern terrorists. And again, the strategy of tension that I mentioned before should be borne in mind in this context. Continuing here with Gene Wheaton's observations. Any federal agent, military officer, aviation accident investigator, anti-terrorist specialist, or even a layman civilian having this information in his possession, Wheaton noted acidly in a memo last January, quote, would have to be comatose, a blithering idiot, or a person with a secret criminal agenda not to have suspected this aircraft was the potential target of a terrorist act, unquote. Extremists would obviously be tempted by any flight carrying soldiers from the Sinai peacekeeping force, and they might find this one particularly attractive. Among its passengers, Wheaton believes, were over 20 crack special forces commandos traveling undercover. Their final destination would have been Fort Campbell, Kentucky, home base of a black, unquote, or covert aviation unit known as Task Force 160, whose members are specially trained for sensitive missions. Wheaton estimates that 20 of the dead were Task Force 160 helicopter pilots, identified on the passenger list as warrant officers, quote-unquote. Another special forces group, according to surviving relatives he has contacted, included paratroopers who would train for hostage rescue. The presence of special forces officers on the flight is a subject whispered about on military bases and at paratrooper conventions. Active duty officers know they are not supposed to question the official story, but rumors abound in the fervid swamp inhabited by mercenaries and private spooks. A former Israeli intelligence officer, who now works for a major insurance firm, has elaborated a theory of the crash which begins with a secret hostage rescue mission in Lebanon and ends with the Aerojet bombing by Americans to conceal the mission's failure. Wheaton considers such notions fanciful. Let me interrupt at this point to say that, to take a look at what we've just seen. There were, at least according to some of the information that Gene Wheaton has received, some people on board the Arrow airplane which went down in Gander, who were themselves very much involved in U.S. counterterror activities. At least according to his suspicions, a number of Task Force 160 helicopter pilots, Task Force 160 being a covert aviation unit heavily involved with counterterror operations, and also, at least according to Scuttlebutt, as it's known, this should be put in the category, obviously, of food for thought and grounds for further research. It has not been established, but there were, according to some people's ideas, a number of special forces operatives, some 20 crack special forces commandos traveling undercover on this plane. Whether or not they were involved in a counter-terror hostage rescue mission in Lebanon remains to be determined. I myself would observe that it is possible that this particular scenario and Wheaton's scenario are not mutually exclusive. I don't know who the former Israeli intelligence officer is. It should be noted that the Pan Am 103 investigator's report was developed by a private intelligence firm called Interfor, I-N-T-E-R-F-O-R, and was headed by a former Mossad officer. Whether or not that's the same individual referred to here, I don't know, but it certainly is interesting, and I think we should consider the possibility that, as was apparently the case with 103, that although the actual people who may have perpetrated the apparent terrorist act, the apparent terrorist bombing of the Gander crash, although the operational people may have been Middle Eastern or Palestinian in origin, that in fact the strings were being pulled by elements within the U.S. intelligence community. We saw that with Pan Am 103, and it may be that if, in fact, the Gander Arrow airplane was brought down by a terrorist bomb, that elements of U.S. intelligence were complicit. Note the use of the term complicit in that act. It remains to be determined. It's also possible that, in certain respects at least, the Gander crash may have been analogous to the Pan Am 103 crash, in that just as the Pan Am 103 crash eliminated the McKee team, very much involved with U.S. counterterror activities, the Gander crash may have eliminated the crack special forces team as well as the Task Force 160 helicopter pilots. Obviously, we cannot draw that conclusion from the information based here, but equally obviously, that question does need to be asked in light of the information that has come to light and the suspicions by reliable researchers like Gene Wheaton and others. And continuing here with Joe Connison's account of Gene Wheaton's observations and research into the Gander crash, to him, that is to say to Wheaton, to him, the main questions revolve around the Iran-Contra affair, which had reached a critical point the week of the Gander crash. In official accounts of the Gander incident, there is no reference to the Iran-Contra affair. Gander is likewise absent from the Iran-Contra story, and there is no immediately obvious reason to consider them together. But Gene Wheaton has spent the past 18 months charting the intersection... One more time. But Gene Wheaton has spent the past 18 months charting the intersections where one provides a motive for covering up the other. The last couple of sentences again. Gander is likewise absent from the Iran-Contra story, and there is no immediately obvious reason to consider them together. But Gene Wheaton has spent the past 18 months charting the intersections where one provides a motive for covering up the other. The Iran-Contra affair, of course, has buried its own truths beneath a welter of testimony, documentation, and official histories, but the outlines are well known. Until they were exposed in the fall of 1986, officials of the Reagan administration were pursuing two simultaneous connected schemes: to sell sophisticated weapons to Iran in exchange for the release of American hostages in Lebanon, and to covertly supply weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua. In zealous pursuit of these aims, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North mobilized not only the official resources of the CIA, but also ostensibly, quote, private, unquote, or proprietary airlines and front companies controlled by retired CIA officers. By the end of 1985, both the Iran arms deal and the covert shipments to the Contras were in full operation. To Wheaton, it seemed odd that nobody inserted the Gander crash within Iran-Contra's voluminous chronology. Sensing that both fell along a single continuum of covert operations, he looked back at the weeks preceding the crash. On November 25, 1985, 3 weeks before the Gander disaster, a shipment of 18 Hawk missiles arrived in Iran on a plane owned by a CIA front company named Saint Lucia Airways. But instead of releasing the American hostages, the Iranians, who had paid $18 million up front, shot back a message of rage. They had been sold a weapon inferior to what they had expected. Quote, "You have cheated us," the Iranian Prime Minister secretly warned President Reagan, "and you must act quickly to remedy this situation."
An anguished debate shook Reagan's National Security Council in the following days, with the Secretaries of State and Defense arguing that the arms for hostages deals were wrong and politically suicidal, and warning North that to renege would provoke a wave of terror. North was frightened. He reminded his superiors of a supposed Iranian guarantee of, quote, no further acts of Shia fundamentalist terrorism, hijackings, bombings, and kidnappings directed against U.S. property or personnel, unquote, and warned about, quote, the likelihood of reprisals against us for, quote, leading them on, unquote. His Iranian contacts had, quote, pointedly noted last week that the wave of Shiite terrorism had subsided with the start of the secret arms negotiations. On December 9th, North again warned that, quote, to do nothing would be very dangerous. U.S. reversal now in midstream could ignite Iranian fire. Hostages would be our minimum losses, unquote. But the next day, at a meeting of the president with his top national security staff, a temporary decision was reached to drop the Iran initiative. That message went out from the State Department and the CIA, which cabled stations that had already been involved in the secret plan. The same message was delivered to the Iranians. 2 days after the weapons trade with Tehran was suspended, the jet went down at Gander. One more time. 2 days after the weapons trade with Tehran was suspended, the jet went down at Gander. Hours later, Islamic Jihad, the Lebanese terrorists controlled by the Iranians, claimed responsibility with an anonymous call in Beirut. This same group was holding hostage the Americans whose freedom was to have been purchased with missiles. Whoever made the call knew that the Arrow Air jet had been delayed during a refueling stop in Cologne, West Germany. That, explained the caller, was why the bomb had exploded over Canada rather than the United States. As Wheaton placed the Gander crash within the already well-known chronology of Iran-Contra, he also looked more carefully at Arrow Air, the Florida charter outfit hired by the Army to carry its soldiers home from the Sinai. Quote, I had already run across Arrow Air as one of those little spook airlines I was looking into down at Miami International Airport, unquote, where, as Wheaton notes, much of the arms traffic to Central America originated. Searching for traces of Arrow in the vast landscape of Iran-Contra, Wheaton discovered that the airline had been used by North's, quote, private operation to haul weapons to the Contras in January and March of 1985. In fact, Arrow was related to a network of air charter firms owned and controlled directly or indirectly by the CIA. Interrupting, of course, we have looked at that in not only in connection with the earlier South Florida Business Journal article about Arrow Air and Arif Durrani, but we've also looked at these air proprietaries in connection with the CIA connection to the savings and loan scandal, and in particular the excellent series of articles from the Houston Post via Pete Bruton, and in particular the complex that we looked at and tubbed, nicknamed Air Azima around Farhad Azima, and Global International Airways and related companies. That miscellaneous series available from Archives on Audio. Continuing here with the Joe Connison article. That Arrow was being used to haul arms to the Contras was an important clue. At least a ton of mysterious cargo had been loaded aboard the Gander flight before it left Egypt. And Wheaton believes that that cargo, in 6 large crates that displaced some of the soldiers' personal effects, could have included anti-tank rockets or other weapons that had been taken from U.S. military stockpiles for use by the Contras. That last paragraph again. That Arrow was being used to haul arms to the Contras was an important clue. At least a ton of mysterious cargo had been loaded aboard the Gander flight before it left Egypt. And Wheaton believes that that cargo, in 6 large crates that displaced some of the soldiers' personal effects, could have included anti-tank rockets or other weapons that had been taken from U.S. military stockpiles for use by the Contras. More important, according to Wheaton, Arrow Air had been directly involved in missile shipments to Iran from Israel in the fall of 1985. Arrow's role in those shipments points, in Wheaton's opinion, to a highly plausible theory. The Iranians blew up the Arrow Air flight in revenge upon those who had, quote, cheated them, unquote. His theory led Wheaton to Arif Durrani, currently in prison for his role in illegal arms sales to Iran, which he insists he was doing with U.S. government approval. Durrani, who was working for the Iranians, said he had visited a Brussels-based airline, quote-unquote, to arrange a secret weapons shipment in 1985. It was, he discovered, a CIA storefront operation, quote-unquote, with no planes or crews of its own. Those were provided by Arrow Air. Durrani also recalls inspecting missiles bound for Tehran aboard an Arrow Air plane in April of 1986. After his arrest, Durrani swore that Arrow was transporting weapons to Iran. He now insists that the charter airlines named in the Iran-Contra affair from St. Lucia to Arrow, quote, all more or less originate from one source, unquote, the CIA. But did the Iranians know about the airlines being used to haul missiles to them? Durrani smiles, quote, the aircraft landed over there. They refuel these aircraft. They have access to all this information, unquote. Durrani has bolstered Gene Wheaton's belief that the bombing of the Arrow jet could have been an act of revenge by terrorists on behalf of the Iranians. There are other suspects, such as the Iraqis, who also had strong motives. Another possibility Wheaton ponders is that the Arrow Air DC-8 was secretly and illegally hauling missiles taken from military stockpiles to be sent to the Contras and was downed by an accidental explosion. If the plane was indeed blown up by a terrorist bomb, anyone who looked too closely at Islamic Jihad or Arrow Air might have exposed the Iran arms sales almost a year before the scandal broke in 1986. Exposure at that stage, as Secretary of State George Shultz had told Reagan, would probably, quote, destroy your presidency, unquote. So there was, Wheaton argues, a powerful incentive against any serious investigation when news of the Gander tragedy reached the White House in the early morning hours of December 12, 1985. Operating without the resources relied upon by most detectives, Wheaton is unlikely to solve the Gander case. There are too many tantalizing leads impossible to pursue without funding or subpoena power. But with Wheaton banging on the wall, sources are coming out of the woodwork, like the angry former CIA officer who called last spring. The ex-agent, who worked on the Iran desk, said he knew all about Arrow Air and who at the CIA had arranged the arms shipments. Then, he disappeared. Still more significant are the reams of classified files on Gander held by the FBI and other agencies, which they have refused to release. The real story is in those files, says Wheaton, who has been trying to pry them loose in cooperation with Terry Taylor, a reporter for KDKA-TV in Pittsburgh, who has done pioneering work on Gander, and Robin Tallon, a Democratic representative from Georgia. I think actually he's from South Carolina, as it was reported. Taylor's station is suing the FBI for its secret files, while Tallon is pressing for a full-scale congressional probe of the crash. Bits of information pointing to a cover-up continue to arrive on Gene Wheaton's doorstep. Not long ago, he was given a page copied from the Pentagon duty officer's log for the morning of December 12, 1985. In a single handwritten paragraph, the log summarizes a series of events that took place over a period of hours after the U.S. government was notified of the Gander crash. Quote, that is the strangest duty officer's log that I have ever seen in my life, and I have handled literally thousands of them, says Wheaton. They are never written like this. Specific events are supposed to be entered as they occur, one by one, at the times they occur. This looks like it has been rewritten, unquote. He noticed something else about the Pentagon log sheet. Less than 4 hours after the crash took place, someone had already recorded what was to become the official version. Quote, suspect icing of the wings as the cause of the accident, unquote. 5 years later, almost nobody accepts that explanation anymore. Nobody except the U.S. government. That concludes this particular article, reviewing some of the facts that we've looked at on this in this last section of it. We reviewed the information concerning the relationship between Arrow Air, the CIA, Southern Air Transport, and the Iran-Contra arms scandal and the attendant arms transactions. We took a look at Arif Durrani's observations once again concerning the Gander crash. We also took a look at the apparently, at least according to Gene Wheaton, rewritten Pentagon log officers, what was the name of that particular, Pentagon duty officers log for the morning of December 12th of 85. According to Wheaton, the entire thing appears to have been rewritten. And interestingly enough, less than 4 hours after the accident, when it appears highly unlikely that this individual could have, had any first-hand information about the actual circumstances of the crash or possible cause, suspect icing of the wings as the cause of the accident. So there is apparently a cover-up. Now, whether or not there was an accidental explosion aboard the Gander flight, as Wheaton says, may have happened, whether or not the Iranians deliberately blew up the plane in revenge for being cheated on what they considered to be inferior arms, that, you know, they got arms, but they were not the arms of a quality that were promised to them, or whether perhaps there was more to it. And I think some of these scenarios may not be mutually exclusive. It's possible that the Iranians were annoyed by getting inferior arms, and that in turn, some of the soldiers involved in the U.S. counter-terrorist capability, meaning the allegations concerning the alleged Special Forces Commandos and the Task Force 160 helicopter pilots, whether or not they had been involved in hostage rescue attempt missions, which themselves may have jeopardized the Iran-Contra transactions. Recall that if Oliver North was getting weapons and funding, was sending weapons to Iran in exchange for hostages, and then using some of the proceeds to finance the Contras, it may be that he did not want, or that people involved with the Contra war did not want these particular connections exposed. They did not want the hostages rescued. Rather, they wanted to buy their release so that they could use the profits made on the arms transactions to finance the Contra war in Nicaragua. It should also be noted that, as we have looked at on so many broadcasts in the past, and here I note very quickly, Radio Free America number 4, Radio Free America shows 19, 20, 21, 25, 30, 31, 32, 34, 35, and the aforementioned two-part miscellaneous series about the fascist third position, elements, oh, and number, let's not forget numbers 22 and 23 either. Those are very important, particularly number 22 and 23. Elements of U.S. intelligence, and again, note the use of the term elements. It's not the entire U.S. intelligence system, but very important elements within it. Elements of U.S. intelligence have long acted in cooperation with world terrorist elements. Basically, that enables them to do a number of things. They can determine the targets that are going to be hit, thereby avoiding the loss of anybody they don't want to get hit. Beyond that, terrorism serves as a marvelous excuse to restrict civil liberties at home in order to protect against the terrorist menace. It also serves as a beautiful excuse for military adventurism abroad. If you want to go drop some bombs on Gaddafi and perpetuate the military spirit that has pervaded this country over the last 10 years or so, setting up a terrorist incident is a good way to justify that reaction. And it's worth considering all of these scenarios in connection with the Gander crash, and it may be that they are not mutually exclusive. It may be that some of the Shiite terrorists who actually planted the bomb, if in fact they did, and if in fact it was a bomb that brought the plane down, maybe they were bombing the plane and out of a motive of revenge, and it may be that elements in U.S. intelligence actively let that go through in order to perhaps avoid disclosure of the Iranian arms transactions, and perhaps to eliminate people who might have jeopardized those transactions, such as the alleged Special Forces Commandos and or the Task Force 160 helicopter pilots reportedly aboard the Gander plane. I would also note in this regard, I'm going to review a very short section of the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators report concerning Manzar El-Kassar and the so-called CIA-1 group that, according to the report, was running Manzar El-Kassar. Now, bear in mind, there was a combination CIA, DEA, and BKA surveillance operation of drug-related, drug-carrying flights and operations at the Frankfurt Airport. Recall that a terrorist collaboration organization dubbed by the Interfor report, the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators report, the Inter-Terror Group, involving, among others, elements associated with Gaddafi, George Habash of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Ahmed Jibril of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, Abu Abbas, Manzar El-Kassar, people associated with the Syrian intelligence services, such as a fellow named Duba or Dubas, D or D-U-B-A, I don't know how it's pronounced, that these elements were cooperating, although, albeit highly imperfectly, in coordinating their terrorist activities, and that the financing for many of these terrorist activities was being accomplished through the drug traffic. The DEA was surveilling one heroin trafficking route through the Frankfurt airport, and they were working with the BKA, the West German Federal Police Service, the equivalent of our FBI, and the so-called CIA-1 group that was operating Manzar El-Kassar. We speculated that the DEA Operation Korea, C-O-R-E-A, may very well have been a front for CIA activities. Recall that these, according to the Interfor report, the CIA-1 group was referred to at CIA headquarters, their communications under the moniker of Korea. All communications to the CIA-1 group were conducted under the moniker of Korea, C-O-R-E-A, the same spelling as Operation Korea, as reported by ABC TV on 10/31/90. Operation Korea was, according to ABC TV, the name for the DEA sting operation, which may have been used as the vehicle for slipping a bomb, the fatal bomb that ended the flight of Pan Am 103, into the luggage of Khalid Jafar. We looked at that last week. Khalid Jafar apparently working as a drug courier for the Manzar al-Qassar terror-connected drug operation. Also, quite possibly, a DEA informant as well. And it appears, at least from the information we developed last week, that Khalid Jafar was the perhaps unwitting transporter of the bomb onto board the plane that ended his life, as well as the lives of the McKee team, which had come across the Manzar al-Qassar CIA-1 connection.